because invariably people are at a shiva or they're at a wake or a celebration of life or they're at a party, whatever it is that commemorates that person, however people find themselves, it is the bittersweet stories. It's the spirit of that person and how they've left this world. It's the stories that those people have cultivated with you that gets you through this time. I don't think that there's anything else other than time. This is the best balm that we have for our souls, is the stories that we keep with the people that we've known.
This is the When You Die podcast. If it has to do with death and dying, we're talking about it. I'm Johanna Lunn, your host today.
With me today is Michael Brook, someone who truly has a lot of irons in the fire. He is a storyteller, a spreader of ideas, and passionate about skateboarding. As a publisher and writer, he created the magazine Concrete Wave, which was dedicated to the skateboard industry. Michael is also founder of Time for My Story, which works with people to tell their life stories or to capture special events and turn them into a magazine. He's also worked as an assistant to a funeral director and spent time as a hospice volunteer. His recent book, Endless Wave, Skateboarding, Death, and Spirituality. Welcome, Michael. I am so happy to be talking to you today.
Well, the feeling is mutual. Delighted to be here and hope I can at least be amusing or entertaining or useful to some of your listeners.
You are always all of that, always all of that. There's lots of things that we can talk about, but let's start with your recent book. I think when you put death and skateboarding together, the first thought is, what? Like, why does that work? Because you think of skateboarding, if you're not an athlete in that business, but someone watching from afar, as kind of a go for it, punk, free-spirited kind of thing, which is sort of the opposite of death. Can you just tell me a little bit, because I know this book is so much more than just skateboarding in a lot of ways. Could you just sort of tell our listeners, what's this about?
So the story is rather interesting. For over 25 years, I wrote about skateboarding and had a magazine, as you mentioned. And in 2018, I sold this magazine. I had writer's block and I felt I told enough stories and I really didn't know what else to write about. And the craziest thing happened is I answered an ad for a funeral director's assistant at a local funeral home. So the juxtaposition from going from Southern California, which is where I spent most of my time and energy and all these events and just rolling along in the skateboard world, took a left turn in Albuquerque, and I wound up working in this funeral home. And when I arrived there, COVID was just around the corner, and I started to write about my experiences at the funeral home. I got to see things, obviously, there that most people don't get to see. And I came in perhaps as a publisher, a journalist, or just somebody with a different set of eyeballs, because the vast majority of people that I worked with who were funeral directors, this was their career. And I knew instinctively this was not going to be my career. The people of my team, the funeral director's assistants, had come from a variety of different careers. Some had been in sales, some had worked in media, oddly enough. And the whole sense of where I was going with this is, you know what? This is helping me to fix my writer's block. And it's a bit of a dog bites man versus man bites dog story. But there is this crazy juxtaposition, intersection of how do you go from skateboarding to death? And I realized that my book, in co-authoring with Nathan Ho, who's an Australian skateboarder, I realized it could be a catalyst. And it could get those conversations starting with people who normally wouldn't touch this. And men within the death space, as I've very much seen firsthand, have grave difficulty talking and really reflecting on grief and what is transpiring after someone that they love has died. So my whole pretense and my whole sensibility for the next few years really is to use this book as a tool, as a catalyst to begin those very important conversations.
It's also really dedicated to a lot of skateboarders that you have known through the years or people that contributed to that scene who are no longer with us. I realize there are women who are skateboarders, but it definitely, I felt, really brought me into a world of men and issues that they face, not just the skateboarding side of it, but real life pressures and depression and even suicide in some cases and other stuff we really, really don't talk about. So I found it really a heart-opening book because it did sort of open my eyes to this broader issue of men.
Yeah, you know, I have to say this, men are a problem. We bundle our emotions inside. And look, I feel very strongly that having been so close to these positions of true intimacy, you know, I'm the one holding an umbrella next to a family at a casket. So all the onlookers are wondering, what are the conversations? People are asking me, you know, what did you see? Some of these stories I'm able to convey, others remain private, but ultimately I have been there and I have seen things that very few people have really seen. And as a result, I feel that I become that bridge. I become a way of sort of filtering out some of the heaviness that surrounds this topic. I in no way want to take away from people who work in bereavement and grief. The specialists do what they do magically, and I'm hoping that people will read the book and turn to the professionals. I am not a professional in this case. I am somebody who says we've got a severe problem as it relates to mostly men who are bundling up emotions. And I can say this with pride. I come from England, but the part of England I come from is Yorkshire, and you know, you're Yorkshiremen and Yorkshire women, but mostly men up there, they don't talk. It's like everything is kind of closed and bundled together. And I feel very strongly that the world's changed, obviously. But for a lot of people, death is the one thing. I laugh because skateboarders have no problem giving blood, you know, at the skate park. They have no problem hurting themselves over and over again on rails and ledges if you're a street skater, hurtling down a hill at 50, 60 kilometers an hour. This is easy. The hard part is opening up about what your feelings were for your mother or your grandmother, or whoever's passed. I find that it just becomes this impenetrable wall. So again, I go back to this idea of, in order to have some impact, the idea of spreading, we need to, you know, talk about death and spirituality in a different way. That's why I made the book free. And so at your website, you can download it. And I don't know how many people have read it. My overall thought process was, if it affects one person's life in a positive way, it's done its job. But realistically, I'm hoping it leads to more conversations.
Absolutely. So have you been getting good feedback? I mean, what are some of the things that people are telling you?
Yeah, so it's been a really interesting thing. I think this is something that for a lot of people, they feel so... I'm not sure they're willing to share a lot of what they get from the book, but I will sort of put that down to that intimacy and those feelings, those are theirs. But I will say there was one person, I'm not going to mention his name, but he was going through a lot and he was dealing with a death in the family and he was dealing with his own mortality as well. And for him, I think the book was a calming presence. I've written books before and I've written some pretty big bestseller books. My first book sold 42,000 copies and was made into movies and all kinds of cool stuff. And I guess where I'm kind of going with this is that at this point, I don't know how else to say it, except if it just is there as somebody just even sees the cover, right? And so says, oh, it's a guy on a skateboard, it's a skeleton. Even if it just gets someone to laugh and I get some sort of reaction that way, or I have a little... what's it called? I made a little flyer up, you know, people will see me at my condo and they look at me. I'm like, aren't you kind of old for that skateboard? And then immediately I say, you're going to pry this from my cold dead hands. And then they look at me and they go, you're really weird. And then I pull out a little flyer for the book. And I said, if you think I'm weird now, wait till you read my book. And so the first baby boomer turns 80 in 2 years, right? So January 1st, 1946, fast forward to 2026, and our first baby boomer turns 80. And you don't need to be a scientist, you don't need to be an actuary to know that 80 is kind of when things start to crumble medically. My father was a physician and he lived till 80, but the vast majority of men in Canada die around 80 something, and the vast majority of women, maybe 85. So we are about to hit an onslaught of death, dying, and people worrying about their medical condition. And I respect that. And I'm one of these people that sort of see life 10 or 15 years down the road. And I think these conversations are happening. There's Death Cafes, is the work that you've done, which is absolutely stunning. And I think also is a great catalyst. But ultimately, there's a huge section of the population that is still really confused, upset, angry, whatever word you want to throw at this conversation. They're just not ready. And they're just not there in their mind. And then when they have to confront it, they are not prepared. So that's, I guess, another impetus is that I know there's a number of people who are not reversing into the future.
Right. Absolutely. One of the things that really got me thinking too was just the analogy of what it takes, the agility and all the faculties that if you are a skateboarder, which I definitely am not, I don't even think I can balance on one. Or I'm not even going to try. But just that analogy for how to work with grief and how to work with navigating toward death. So yes, the book does generate conversation, and that is a gift. Anything that can bring people out and be able to have this conversation, as you and I both know, like this is the greatest gift that we could give people, is the gift of opening to their own mortality and what a relief it is when the floodgates open. Also, I just love that. What does it take to balance on a skateboard? What does it take to balance on the edge of life and death? It's kind of that territory that putting death and skateboarding does for me. It's like, oh, it is. They're both kind of a razor's edge.
You know, that's an excellent point. And believe me, last summer when I, you know, hit a little pebble and tumbled and I came home, I'm bleeding my hip and everything. And my wife kind of looked at me and like, you know, are you kidding me? So the idea that you could die from doing something that, or really injure yourself, and especially, you know, when I'm out there riding in bowls and parks and what have you. And I ride vert. I'm not great at it. My kids are super good, but they're 30 plus years younger than I am. And where I'm laughing about this is that it's that duality. And I think Nathan's probably perhaps, I think he's probably more in tune with this than I am. But I would just say after almost 50 years of riding a skateboard, it's been a Zen-like, a very meditative experience for me. And I get it. I think a lot of people look at traditional street skating, which has been mostly dominated by men for many decades, but now thankfully women are coming on board. But where I'm kind of going with this, the idea of hurling yourself off of a 40 stair or going down a rail at 30, 40 kilometers an hour. The idea of the aggressive, really in-your-face street-style skateboarding, which is balls out. It is wild what's going on. Contrasting that with someone like me who just, I take my skateboard, my surf skate, and I just roll around the streets and there's little bike lanes. And yeah, you can hit a pebble and you can fall. And at 60 falling, I know 80 would be a little different, but I think that's that duality of you're in the moment and then you're not. I talk a little bit about in the book, this idea of sudden death. I guess for me, why this is so critical is because I had such an incredible experience with sudden death. And I'd like to share it, if you wouldn't mind, just explaining. So this idea of being alive and then not being alive hit me with this guy called Noel Corman. And I met Noel on March 11th. I remember the day I met him. It's crazy how I can absolutely recall when it was. So it was March 11th, it was 2011, and it was the world's first longboard expo in New York City. And without getting too detailed, this man was like larger than life. He's like, I can help you. I'm Noel Corman with the Shrapnel's Union. And he was just there to support and just a fun guy. I guess I was with somebody literally 3 years later, and it was December 5th. I got this phone call while I was talking with someone. And normally I'd pick up a phone. And in this case, I didn't pick up the phone. It was my friend Ray Corman, who was Noel's father, calling me. And I thought, just ignore it. And I have to go back. It was actually December 6th. So the meeting ended and I picked up the phone and I heard the voicemail and it was, Michael, Ray's, it's Ray here. Noel's dead. Now, if you have ever had a call like that, more power to you in terms of, like, I guess some people have experienced this. I'd never experienced anything like that. I was 50 years old when I got that call. And of course, I immediately tried to call him back and the lines, you know, completely, I couldn't get him. And of course, the question is, what happened? And so Noel was with his girlfriend, Alice Parks, and they were in this facility in New Jersey, like a warehouse. And the boiler went off, I guess, or something happened with the gas leak or something happened with carbon monoxide and this special heating system. And normally in New Jersey, every home had carbon monoxide detectors. But there wasn't a law in New Jersey that mandated this. So a lot of people got sick, but Noel and his girlfriend, Alice, died. And it was such a stupid death because all they had to do was have a carbon monoxide detection and everyone would have left the building and what have you. So the silver lining in all this and why it's just one of these things that stayed with me is that in New Jersey, there was a law passed in both legislatures to ensure that there was a carbon monoxide detection unit in warehouses, in buildings other than residential. It took a long time for this law to get passed. In the interim, 49 other people died as a result of not having carbon monoxide detectors. And this law, the Parks-Corman law, finally got put into place through a number of different things, which I had a little role to play, and I'm not saying that I did much, but I put together a change.org. I was so incensed that Chris Christie didn't sign off on this law, and obviously his dilly-dallying caused 49 other people to die. But from sudden death to what happened to, oh my God, what can I do to move things forward, that I think if anyone takes anything from this book, it's knowing that one of the best ways to keep someone's memory alive is to literally keep someone's memory alive. Do the work that is required from the loved ones surrounding that person. Ray died, unfortunately, a couple of years later, but Ray had the knowledge that this law had come to pass. And that, I think, I mean, he never got over this, but from my perspective, yes, you're right. The absolute black and white, you're alive 1 minute and then you are in a totally different space the next, is absolutely, it's mesmerizing.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to one of your other many projects, which I absolutely love, Time for My Story. It's great that people can have assistance in capturing their life story, their memoir, or a special event or other things. But it's also critical, I think, as people are either facing a terminal illness or they're aging out, they're coming towards the end, to make meaning of our lives, to take the time, which we never do, to reflect on what's our life been like? What are our victories? Where are the beauty points? Are there regrets? Things that you can work through. And I think that that's so integral. So you're saying, yes, it's really, we want to keep people's memories alive. And certainly there's a lot being talked about now in terms of continuing bonds, that grief isn't something you get over, but you have a continuing relationship with people, even who you've lost 40 years ago, and that's healthy. So being able to share a story and work with someone through telling their story is an incredible, incredible gift, not just to the families and loved ones, but to them, to help tease out a story. How did that come about for you? Where was this idea, this light bulb?
So it's really funny. The funeral home presented me with an opportunity to listen to a lot of eulogies and a lot of stories. And I estimate in the 5 years I was there, and I was there during COVID, so it was a remarkable period to go through. Sometimes funerals will have hundreds of people, but I had 10 people, including in the clergy. So I got to see and hear a lot of stories. And what I could sort of discern was that the families that had that bond, that crucial family tie bond, the ones that flourished were the ones that had these amazing stories, that grandpa or grandfather, mother, father, whatever, whoever the person was, it was the stories that the grandchildren and the sons and daughters and the cousins and the uncles, those are the ones that people reflect upon. And I thought, yes, this family had made magic. The memories were there and the stories were part of that magic. And I realized that so many of these stories were being buried with the people. And it was that insight that said, you know what, I'm a storyteller. I like gathering stories. I've interviewed hundreds of people, but I'm also a magazine publisher, and everybody's got these phones and they've got literally tens of thousands of pictures on their phones or on their hard drives. And in 100 years from now, no one will know who these people are. The photos won't have any, they won't tie in with anything. It'll just be an image. And so for me, it was this insight of, if you do a memoir that's 400 pages and it's, you know, I was born in 1922 and it's filled with words, today's generation, they may be interested, but the vast majority of kids, and I say this as a parent, the vast majority of people today are photo-driven. Instagram, it's all Snapchat. It's kids who are in their teens right now do not probably wish to sit down and read 400 pages. But if there's photos and there's captions and there's this weaving of both a narrative and images, well, then all of a sudden you might have something that stands the test of time. I don't want to take anything away from people who write 50, 60,000 word memoirs. Conversely, I don't want to take anybody's wonderful things that they produce as a photo book. But in between those two things, I want to build a culture of capturing and preserving stories that either you do it with me, or you do it with AI. I have a little booklet, and obviously I can't show it because it's a podcast, but it's five questions. And in this booklet, you can discern so much from people. I'm sorry for the rambling and rustling here, but basically what it boils down to is, what is your philosophy of life? Who impacted you the most? What's a pivotal moment? But these little questions in this booklet, I did this at a workshop a few days ago, and it was with nine people. And at the end, it had triggered more stories, more interest. These women had known each other for decades, but they never sat down and shared these types of stories and memories. And so the recounting of stories, I call this the glue that sort of forms who we are as humans. It's the glue of humanity. And this ties back into the work that you're doing, because invariably people are at a shiva, or they're awake, or a celebration of life, or they're at a party, whatever it is that commemorates that person, however people find themselves. It is the bittersweet stories. It's the spirit of that person and how they've left this world. It's the stories that those people have cultivated with you that gets you through this time. I don't think there's anything else other than time. This is the best balm that we have for our souls, is the stories that we keep with the people that we've known.
Absolutely. All right. Can you please share with our audience, where could people find out more about Time for My Story?
Sure. It's at timeformystory.com. And my whole thing with this is that you don't have to spend money with me. If you steal my idea, we'll give you a free booklet. Just, you know, send us an email or whatever. It's very simple. Just take the time to preserve something. I don't have anything of my father's. And he died 9 years ago. He was a very quiet man. I told you he's from Yorkshire. And just the process of sitting down and doing five questions, that would have made a huge difference. So the timeformystory.com, we'll write about your skate story. You know, all skateboarders are welcome. But beyond that, the way I kind of view it is, if people are overloaded, I find in some families, you'll have a champion. You'll have somebody who says, you know what? We've got all the photos. We've got the bus tickets from 1942 when they were in Vienna. We've got this. And someone is like taking it on as their role to be the holder of the family's memories. And if you're that person, and if you, I think there's a direct correlation between you listening to this podcast and being on whenyoudie.org. If you are that person and you feel burdened, there are so many resources. I'm happy to help. Literally, you are not alone. There are wonderful ways to capture stories. And I often tell people, just start with something, even if it's just a postcard. And that's kind of how we do it with Time for My Story. So yeah, I definitely feel this spark is now growing, because there's so many people who are in their 60s and 70s and now approaching 80s who are reflecting. There's such great therapy in that. And there's a whole bunch of other things I'm doing with artificial intelligence and memory capturing. And that's the next frontier of it. Yeah, if you're swamped by photos and you're swamped with memories and you need to sort of bring it into a 24 or 48 page or how many page document, that's what I specialize in doing. I turn people's memories into magazines and books.
Amazing. You're absolutely right about story is the thing that has been our binding thread through thousands of years, going back to stories that were captured hundreds of years after they happened because there was an oral tradition. This is really critical. And I know in my own family, there's some members of the family, grandparents and great-grandparents wrote their stories down. And what a gift that is to now two generations downstream from me, to be able to say, wow, they came from Sweden. They lived where? What was it like? It's a wonderful thing. And I think you're right about our current time is that we are media rich. I don't know about you, but I have got probably six giant Rubbermaid containers full of photos. And everyone in my family is like, well, when are you going to do something with it? Which strikes horror into my heart. You know, it's like, well, someday I'll get there, you know?
Yeah. And that's my catchphrase with all this, which is there's no time like the present to capture the past. I guess just to build on something here, it's really funny. Social media is something that has kind of created bonds, and there are people that, you know, swear by it. And I was on social media for quite a long time when I had my business. And I have often liken it to a dragon that just you keep feeding coal to, and it just keeps breathing, and it has this intensity. But ultimately, I feel, Jonna, that the pendulum is sort of swinging, and it's swinging back to a point where people are saying, huh, what really, really matters? And, you know, there's a lot of podcasts about a lot of different subjects, and I find myself gravitating to the political ones, the ones about sociology. But ultimately, and I had an experience yesterday with a wonderful lady, And this woman's an artist, but she's written books on death and dying. I'm going to introduce you to her. I don't want to give too much away, but Julie's a very special person. And we spent about an hour and a half, almost two hours yesterday talking. And what I came away from this is that this little book I wrote, I did it for one reason. And that was I started to chip away at my writer's block. And that was a real problem for me. I literally pivoted. I moved from being a publisher in skateboarding to working, you know, so that story I told myself that you can't write anymore. You have no more stories to tell. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty big story, and that impacted me. Yeah. But where I'm kind of tying this back is, what really is a quality of life? What really do we love doing? And I can only suspect, I'm suspecting this, that the people that are beholden to social media and the people that are out there posting, and again, I can't take away from it because it's a juggernaut, and I don't want to fight Mark Zuckerberg. But what I'm beginning to realize is that when you go about the business of reflecting on your life, and when you start to really discern what makes you happy and what really counts, a lot of stuff just flitters away. So the time I'm spending with you, which is almost reaching, I guess, 45 minutes, I've lost track of time. That's quality time. That's something that I know I can build on. And I know that you and I have a connection, and I love what you're doing with, you know, whenyoudie.org. And I know there's lots of people I can take your idea to. And conversely, that helps me. And if you show people time for my story, but ultimately it's this human connection that I think really just motivates me. I see that as my life's work for the next, well, if I've got 20 or 30 years worth of quote unquote work, I don't see myself stop working. But I think ultimately, if someone asked me, what's the root of all this? It's because I think there's so many people that are longing for quality human connection to generate the stories that will eventually one day be in a binder or wherever.
Or passed down orally, you never know.
You never know. Those are tough ones to do, though, because invariably people can't remember what they had for breakfast yesterday. So I will grant you that. But it's a delight to be in this milieu. I just feel this is the right place for me. And, you know, next week I start work at a hospice volunteering. And part of the whole project there is to capture people's stories just before they die. So I'm putting that out there, and I've got the tools to be able to do that. And that just feels like, that's why I spent 5 years working in funeral services. So I know how to read a room. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
That's great. That's great. I love that you're doing that. Well, why don't we wrap it up here? I know we've covered a lot of ground, and it's so, so great spending this time with you. And Endless Waves, Skateboarding, Death, and Spirituality is available as a free download. And we will have that link to this podcast as well. I believe it's on our website, whenyoudie.org. And of course, timeformystory.com, another really great thing that you're involved in. And I just want to thank you for your service and all the things that you're doing, and look forward to so much more.
Well, thank you, Joanna. I so admire what you've done with the three films. I know the third one's about to hit publicly, but having seen all three and what they represent, I mean, your timing obviously is one thing, but I just think how they resonate. And I think really what it boils down to in terms of what I get from your work is a sense of comfort and peace. And both the three films do such a magical job of offering those really, I guess the best way to explain it would be really a feeling of serenity and tranquility that's what I feel you do best with. And that's what those three films generate, along with your website. There's a sense of just a warm sigh. So that's how I felt about them, at least.
Thank you.
This conversation is brought to you by the When You Die Project. From existential afterlife questions to palliative care and the nuts and bolts of green burial, if it has to do with death, we're talking about it. WhenYouDie.org.